Veterans Day 2006. This Veterans Day program, you'll hear the voice of the late O.D. Tully from Tom Brokaw's Greatest Generation. As you listen to the program, keep in mind it was recorded at the Gunnersville Lions Club meeting October of 1998.
I knew him as not only his neighbor, but the longtime veteran service officer. And he had a program every week on the radio. I think it's about a weekly program on the radio station about veterans affairs. That was aired weekly on Saturdays at WGSV. And looking back through some of the old minutes in their history, we found out that 52 years ago that I saw where my neighbor had spoke to the Gunnersville Lions Club. He said Lion O.D. Tully told of his experiences as a prisoner of war. And that same year, we had a Congressman, Joe Starnes, spoke to our club, told of his experiences and observations in the European theater of war. We had a United States Congressman from right here, lived here in Gunnersville. That same year, two or three other little things here we done. We redecorated and furnished a room at the hospital. We purchased an artificial eye for a young boy. And instead of paying a dollar for our meal at the Lions Club meeting that night, we paid only 50 cents and got a vegetable plate and contributed the difference, the other 50 cents, to the United Relief Association. So that was 1946, fellas, 52 years ago. O.D., we're glad to have you with us, and I know that there's been a lot, you know, about the military experiences, and there's a movie that's been real hot now, Saving Private Ryan. A lot of folks watched that movie. But I know your experience must be, I've seen it on television, it's kind of like Hogan's Heroes, I assume. So about the Stalag, whatever. 13, is that the one they were in?
Stalag Loop 1.
Yours, wait a minute, I've got you. I'm going to turn you on right here and turn it on to you. What was you? They were Hogan's Heroes at Stalag 13.
17. They were 17.
All right.
But, of course, in German, Stalag means prisoner. And Stalag Luft, which I was in, means it was an air prisoner, airman's camp. But anyway, going back for just a minute, Bill talking about 46 years ago. 52 years ago in 46. I was a member of the Lions Club and back then, and of course I had an ulcerated stomach and belly trouble that I'd picked up in prison camp World War II. And a lot of times, they used to meet in the old Glover Hotel up there across the street from where the Glover at Covington's is now. And I can remember Russell Benefield was there that night. Clarence Porch was there that night, and by the way, there's a lot that was there then that's done gone on, like Bob Bishop, Elton Kinnamer, Russell Copeland, Bookie Copeland, R.W. Bishop, Warden Harrison, by the way, they done gone on. But reason I left the Lions Club, back then, if you missed two meetings nights in a row, you was expelled. Well, I'd go to Lions Club, my belly was hurting, so I'd tell Edith, I said, I'm not going nowhere. So I got on the probation list and I found out old Pocket Woods, High Pockets they used to call it, he had got a member at large status because he drove a truck hauling cars in and out of Gunnersville. And he could attend when he was in town and sort of his pleasure. And I asked him to put me on that till I could get straightened out on my stomach. And they wouldn't do it. And I said, well, I'll just drop out. And I did. But I've always sort of wished I'd stayed on. But anyway, I enjoyed it. But Bill, talking about the experience I had during World War II, it's something that I wouldn't wish on anybody, but it's something I wouldn't take $1 million for. Because I found out that there was two things that are very dear in life that you can't buy and can't really put a price on. And that's your freedom and your health. When you lose one of them or both of them, you're in bad shape. But first day of December 1943, we were shot down over, we was on a raid to Cologne, Germany. That particular day, we was flying a split mission. Half of the division was going to Cologne, to the railroad yards, and the other half was, squadrons was going to a ball bearing plant there in Leverkusen, which is right across the Rhine River. And of course, we always, on a mission, they programmed you, had a pre-planned airspeed into the target, drop the bombs, and then a pre-airspeed to come out. But if you got over the target and that anti-aircraft got one of your engines, why, you couldn't keep up. And I'll guarantee you that the missions I flew that before went down, boy, when the old B-17s had dumped their bomb loads, they had just pull that throttle back and head to the barn. They didn't pay no attention to that speed that's supposed to be flying. Well, we got caught over the target and lost an engine. And of course, we became Tail End Charlie, and just as soon as we got out of the flak over the target, the German fighters swarmed on us. And luckily, we were flying about 22 or 3,000 feet that day. And as soon as they hit us, why, we knew we was in for a long day, and the pilot dropped the plane down his bank of clouds down there. We were about 2,000 or 3,000 feet above clouds. So we went into the cloud bank and flew at about 14,000 or 15,000 feet for it seemed like 30 or 40 minutes. And then we burst out into the open over the town of Aachen, which is right in the corner of Belgium and Germany and the Netherlands. And when we burst out into the clear, the Germans threw everything but the kitchen sink up there. And we, of course, had to hit the deck. So we went down to about 200 feet and started trying to fight our way out. But, of course, when you get down that low, it knocks out any fighters that might come at you on the belly, but they come down from the top. So you had them out on the perimeter. But we had a running fight with them, and one group of 190s or Messerschmitts 109 would take us till they ran out of ammunition or fuel or both. One group would drop us, another group would pick us up. And we had a running fight till we got to the mouth of the Rhine River, and I was sitting in the nose of that B-17. And I could see the channel, even at 200 feet. But we were shot up so bad, the pilot got on intercom, and he said, well, says, you boys want to bail out or crash land or ditch? And on intercom, everybody said, bail out. He said, well, as soon as I get enough altitude, we'll go. Well, right quick, he came back on, and he said, well, we change your mind because it was shot up so I can't get enough altitude where you can bail out. So you got a choice of ditching or crash landing on a dike down there. So we said, well, let's ditch in the river. So we rode that thing into the mouth of the Rhine River. And I don't know yet exactly how I got out of the river. I remember going down, we had shot up over ammunition and had some, all the crew was shot up, three dead on the ship. And after we hit the water, it didn't stay afloat, but just three or four minutes. Well, me and the pilot got out of the cockpit. One dinghy would inflate. We put all the crippled, the worst shot up, put them in the dinghy, and the ones that could, they just held on to help came. Well, me and the pilot decided we could make it on our own, and we stepped off the wing into the river. And boy, I'm telling you what's the truth. I never felt such an undertow or undercurrent in my life, because I found out later that there's a 20-foot shipping channel all the way up to that river to Amsterdam. Well, I got bobbing like a cork there, and you always heard this old saying that when you're drowning or about to drown, that your life flashes before your eyes. Well, by the way, that's a lot of truth to it. Well, I bobbed about twice, and I thought, well, I'll just tread water and let the current carry me to shore. Well, that didn't work either, and I passed out in the water, and when I came to, I was stretched out flat on my back on a dike over there at a little old fishing village called Strivik on Rhine. And there's a bunch of German home guards that was there, and that little old short fella, shorter than Jesse there, he's standing over me, and he had a long barrel squirrel rifle. And that thing wasn't no further than that right there from my nose. Looked like he was just waiting for me to move. And when I did wake up enough or come to enough, it happened as a little teenage girl there, about 15 or 16 years old. And she could speak good English. She had studied in England through a church convent. And she was very fluent in English. And I asked her, I said, where are we? And she told me. I said, well, how in the world did I get out of that river? I said, I don't remember nothing. She said, well, I said, the fishermen saw y'all were in trouble and started out to the river when they saw you was going to ditch, and said they fished you out of the water and brought you in. So that's how I survived that day. But all of them, all my crew, it wasn't killed. Ball turret gunner was dead in the ball turret. Tail gunner was dead in the tail. And of course the pilot drowned in the river. And it happened that day that our co-pilot was flying on another crew, and he was shot down and killed that day too. So actually of our original crew of 10, four was killed that day. But anyway, they gathered up enough of us POWs to carry us down to, they carried me to the municipal prison in Amsterdam, and I stayed there 2 weeks. And I don't remember much about it because I had flak fragments in the back of my hand and my shoulders, and they got infected, and I was running a fever. And two things I can remember out of my stay there at Amsterdam was, first thing, I was laying on a cot, and our cells was the dungeon. It was the old medieval prison there in Amsterdam. And I guess we was in the basement or dungeon part of it, because I was stretched out on a cot or half bed or something. And I didn't have on nothing but a felt electric lined flying suit. And what woke me up or snapped me out of my daze was rats chewing on my toes. I looked down there and I saw a rat as big as a house cat, and I just kicked foot at it and they scurried away. But I don't remember much after then, except when they'd bring my meals, they'd rattle the door and then slide a bowl under it. Had an iron grate looking thing door, about that much clearance between the floor and the bottom of the door, and then slide a bowl of food under there, and it, what I would call, we used to drench cows with it when they'd get sick, called it gruel. But this was some kind of soup that they'd mixed up, you know, and as sick as I was, I couldn't eat it. But anyway, they gathered up enough of us POWs or airmen that was shut down that day, and carried us down to the interrogation center at right out of Frankfurt, Germany. Well, they put us in a, what I'd call a cattle car on the train. And as we went down the Ruhr Valley and went through Koblenz and Cologne and down through there, every time we'd pull into a train station, why, I don't know how it came about, but every time we'd pull into a train station, the bunch of civilians would be running up there at the window and they'd be spitting at us and cussing us and everything. And if we hadn't had guards at each end of the car to keep them out, I don't think we'd ever made it. But anyway, we went on to the interrogation center, and the Germans was trying to find out, we didn't know till later, that they was trying to find out about a new bomb site that the 8th Air Force was using. We had always up to, till that time, been using what they called a Norden bomb site, which was controlled by gyroscopes, and you had to see the target and home in on it visually to drop your bombs. But this new bomb site was had radar, and you could bomb through the clouds with it because it had a screen and you could chart your coordinates on there, geographic coordinates. And when you got those centered, well, you knew if you knew the coordinates of your target, well, when you locked in on it, well, you just dropped your bombs. And the Germans knew that they was fixing to come out with it or we had it. And they thought, and actually that day, two of the crews in our division was flying with them, those bomb sites. But they was trying to interrogate all of us to find out what we knew, and they kept us about a week or 10 days there and like froze us to death. But anyway, we finally got out of there and went to camp there in Frankfurt, and they gathered us up and shipped us all up to the Baltic Sea. That's 110 miles due north of Berlin. They had we went into a camp that was already established, and the previous occupants of the camp were British sergeants and military people that had been captured at the Battle of Dunkirk in 1939. And what they'd done, they'd built a new POW camp out in Poland. They transferred all of those British boys out there and started in with this camp, Stalag Luft 1, and it was nothing but Allied air officers that were captured. Well, I was in the first 150 that went in there on December 22nd, 1943. And I was the last plane load of 15,000 that flew out of there on May the 15th of 1945. So you can sort of get an idea of the price that was paid to wage the air war there in World War II. But after, when we first got to POW camp, it was pretty rough because it wasn't as rough as it got. But the Germans were still winning the war then. They had all of Europe occupied, and if Hitler had had any sense and known it, he could have invaded England and just took it over. That'd been all she wrote. But for some reason or another, he held off the invasion. And the whole time we was in England, before we were shot down, every night you'd come over bombers over England, air raid siren call, winter rattle and shake, rope, and it was unsettling to say the least. But the Germans was winning the war, and they sort of treated us as, well, we tolerate you and we feel sorry for you. And I never did imagine that an entire people could get brainwashed like the Germans were. They had cut off all radio, all controlled all the newspapers. And the only news that those German people got was what Hitler and Hermann Göring would allow to come out. And they actually thought that they was going to win the war. And I know I had a, we tried to talk to them there, some of the guards that could speak English, and tell them about what was going on in England and around the world, who all was in war and fighting against Germany and all. And they'd laugh at you because they thought you were trying to flim-flam them. I know I had one guard that I was telling him, his name was Heinrich. I kept telling him about what it's like in this country and everything. And he didn't believe me or what I was telling to him. He had a son that was a fighter pilot in the German Air Force. And he was shot down over England. And they shipped him from England to a POW camp in the States. And he wrote to his parents and tell them about being able to go to the movies and going to the canteen and what he could buy and what he could get. And Heinrich, he told me, he said, well, said, if that hadn't happened, said, I'd never have believed it because we just thought it was propaganda that y'all were putting out about what was going on. So they were completely brainwashed. And as long as they were, things were sort of going their way, we fared fairly well. But as they started to lose the war, the screws began to tighten down on us. And we sort of, the end of our confinement there, we got eaten pretty poorly. Actually, the food all the time we was there consisted mostly of some kind of meat. It was ground up about a chili grind of hamburger meat. And you didn't know whether it was horse meat, beef, or what. But they'd make it up into a soup with dehydrated vegetables and just dish it out to you. And if you could eat it, all right. If you couldn't, well, that was too bad. But toward the end of the war, and the Russians broke out of Poland and started driving to the American and British lines, for about 6 weeks there, we didn't have a thing in the world to eat except potatoes. And you talk about the flattest thing you've ever tried to eat is a boiled potato with nothing but the jacket on it. No butter, no salt, no nothing. Now, it's just flat in a hurry. But one of the things about being in prison camp, we found out that American ingenuity, I guess, but after we'd been there a while, and at the beginning we could get the Red Cross food parcels through Geneva, and when they'd come in, they'd have some sea rations, field rations, a chocolate bar, cigarettes, and a pack of coffee or RT, not both. But as long as we could get one of those a week, we could do pretty well. But they got to where the trains bringing them through into Germany, the civilians was looting the trains and all, and Red Cross was discontinued shipping them in. But we, if we'd been there a while, our parents and families could send us cigarette parcels. And that worked through the Red Cross, and what they'd do would just have them shipped direct from the cigarette factory to the prison camp. And you could get six cartons, I don't know, it was every month or ever so often. But anyway, after we'd been there a while, we got a pretty good stash of cigarettes on hand. And you could get on the black market, and you could trade for anything the Germans had that you wanted for a pack of cigarettes. A pack of cigarettes would buy you more than a truckload of German money. And some of us had been there long enough that through a Red Cross parcels and what our family was sending us to, we had so many cigarettes on hand and could trade and traffic for so much stuff, the Germans put a little old building out in the middle of the compound, and we were wondering what was going on, and they set up a cigarette bank out there. We had to take all the cigarettes we had, except one cart, 10 packs, deposited in that cigarette bank out there.
This was kind of like Hogan's Heroes.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you something about it happened one night there. The night, 10 o'clock, they'd come around and lock you down, they call it. And we was in old shotgun barracks like they had built here in this country during wartime, just shotgun and tar paper and stuff like that. Well, they had wooden shutters on the window and then just door at each end of the hall. And the guards would come around 10 o'clock and lock the doors and turn out the lights. And that was it for about 7 o'clock the next morning when they'd follow you out for roll call. Well, they had barracks that are sort of in the middle of our compound that they didn't have nothing in it but Russian POWs. And they'd use them to clean out the trains and the sewers, and the Polish forced labor to come in there with these sewer wagons, and they'd empty up the sewage and all and haul it out. And they treated those Russians like, as the old boy says, they treated them poorly. But one night the Russians were celebrating one of their, I don't know whether it's Lenin's birthday or what, but anyway, they had got a hold of some hops or snops or something, and they, after they locked them down, they got drinking, carousing, hooping and hollering, singing in there, and so these German guards at night when they'd patrol, they had these dogs, like using our prison. And so they kept trying to get those Russians to quiet down and all, and they wouldn't. So what they did, we found out the next day, the guards just opened up each end of the barracks, turned them dogs in there and just shut the door. Well, next morning when they come around and do roll call on us, outside the Russian building, there's about 6 dog skins with bones, nothing but bones in it, tied together and pissed out. They killed them dogs, skinned them, and cooked the meat off of them and pissed the bones right out there in, out there in the yard. But they used to, we had to get used to it when we got over there, that you couldn't say much in front of those German guards, because I'd say 99 out of 100 of them could speak fluent English. I know what their intelligence officer they had there, he was an antique art dealer from Van Nuys, California. And boy, he looked as sharp as Dr. Christopher, spoke English fluently. But then you'd see some old dried up, swivel looking boy. I know I had one guard that I'd call him pint-sized or pinochle, but his name is Tisch, which means table in German. And I didn't know for a long time that he could understand English. He never did speak it, but he could understand it. And you had to watch, because if you got to running off the mouth about those so-and-so Germans and all, you'd find yourself in the solitary up there on bread and water. We had a Texas colonel in the Air Force. He was a colonel when he was in prison camp, but he went on to be a major general and head of the whole tactical Air Force in Europe, a general Spicer. But he was a colonel the time he hit prison camp. So one day, cold winter day, they had a habit of falling out. If they had a suspicion that you had any kind of escape materials in your barracks, or you're trying to dig a tunnel or something to escape, why, the SS would come in, and while he was out on roll call, they would just lock the door and go in and search the barracks and bring in their dogs and everything else. Colonel Spicer I believe it was in the fall of 44. It was a cold day. And while he'd just been there a few days, and he was the officer in charge of that barracks, but when they locked him out, he got up on the stump out there and he began to preach to these POWs about those sorry crap SOBs and all this, that, and that, and what they'd do to them, this, that, and that. Well, boy, they yanked him down from there and just like to beat him half to death before they could get him in them. They called it the cooler. Well, we didn't have to work as part of our imprisonment, but chores around the camp, and all, if you want something to occupy your time and all, you could do it. And I was worked in the cookhouse or the kitchen for our compound, and it fell my duty a lot to see that the POWs in the cooler got their daily chow. And I know I'd go over there, and old Colonel Spicer, he was one of these long, lanky Texans, and he had one of these handlebar mustaches. He's flying out of England, and he had one of those English-type mustaches twist up. And boy, you talk about the air'd be blue around there some days when you'd go over there, and he'd have it out with some of those German guards, you know. And he'd tell them what he was going to do when he got out or he got liberated, you know. And it was quite comical just to see going on. But a friend of mine, he is a Brooklyn Jew, named David Feldman. And he beat all I ever saw. He taught me how to play cribbage. But he was so crooked, when he'd get to playing checkers with somebody, if it's the middle of winter, they'd make him push his sleeve all the way up, both arms, because if you left him with his sleeve down, he would get the checkerboard and he'd get his men, he'd get doing that way, and the first thing you know, he'd move that elbow or that sleeve over there and move his backcourt men so everybody got to where they knew he was cheating. They got to where they'd make him roll his sleeves up before they'd let him sit down to the checkerboard. But you met some characters. And incidentally, 10 miles from where we were, I don't know whether it rings a bell with you fellas or not, but have you ever heard of Peena Mundi?
On Broadway.
They were 10 miles down the road from where we were, Peena Mundi, and they were doing buzz bomb down there. And after we were liberated, we went down there to the laboratories, because the Russians liberated us, and we had 15 days there. The Russians wouldn't let us leave, but they wouldn't try to get us out. They really wanted to take us from all the way up on the Baltic Sea, right south of Sweden, back through Poland, down through Russia, to the Black Sea, and put us on ships and bring us back to England. And we were 40 miles from the British American lines down there at Rostock, and they had plenty of cargo trucks that could move us just like that. Well, they finally, after haggling for 2 weeks, and they wouldn't talk and negotiated nothing but the Russian language. Well, out of 15,000 POWs, they didn't have it about 10 that was fluent enough to sit in on the negotiations. And they haggled there for 2 weeks, and finally, the commander of the 91st Bomb Group in England, when the war was over and they was flying all these victory celebrations over Paris and all over Europe, he said, well, said, if the Russians agree to it and give us a corridor, we'll fly these POWs out. So that's why we flew out of there after 2 weeks of haggling. And they gave them they had set up reception camps in North France, and they named them after cigarettes. Camp Lucky Strike, Chesterfield, on the Old Road, and stuff like that. And they said, well, they wanted us, Germans wanted us flown back directly to England. but they weren't set up to receive us. So they said, well, we'll give you a 5-mile corridor to fly over in and out. But some of the boys, when I got to France, I found out that they got to hold some of these pilots that was sort of new or sort of ancient on the way back to France. They'd say, well, we'll shut down here at Leipzig. Says, how about swinging down here and let's see what it looks like now since we were shot down. And they'd get out of that 5-mile zone, you know, the Russians would shoot up there, anti-aircraft and all, and they'd get back in that damn corridor in a hurry, I'll tell you. But they was just that cantankerous. So it was, like I said, quite an experience. After we was liberated and came back, I wouldn't take $1 million for the experience, but I wouldn't give you a nickel for another one. But after all of that transpired and all, and while I was sitting over there in prison camp, I had a lot of time to think, meditate, or think about things. And you got to really appreciate your country and your home and your family. And if I'd have had any idea, sitting over there in 1945, that we'd wind up in 1998 with a damn draft-dodging, confessed liar in the White House, I'd have said, I ain't no way I'm buying that. But that's what we've got. But you know, all of us has got children, grandchildren, and each generation of kids, they have a name for somebody that's a little peculiar. Right now, if you sort of unique or a little peculiar, they call you a dork. You're a dorky. A while back, last decade, it was a nerd. Then, before that, it was a turkey. Well, back when I was a kid growing up and all, and right after World War II, if you was a little off-center or peculiar, they'd call you a square. Well, I've got something here that a friend of mine, he was a graduate of Amherst University, and he was my bridge partner in prison camp. And he wrote this, and I like to read it to you because I think maybe this is something that you can take with you from this meeting. It might lodge with you and mean something to you. I know it has to me. This boy was, his name is Art Hensler, and he's a lawyer, and he married a Birmingham girl. I don't know if any of you remember the old Bass Lumber Company in Birmingham, but it was quite a big outfit, and he married into it. But this is The Return of the Square, it's called. It says, square, another of the good old words, has gone the way of love and modesty and patriotism. Something to be snickered over or laughed outright at. It used to be that there was no higher compliment you could pay a man than to call him a square shooter. The promise of a square deal was once as binding as an oath on the Bible. But today a square guy, a square is a guy who volunteers when he doesn't have to. He's a guy who gets his kicks from trying to do a job better than anyone else. He's a boob who gets so lost in his work that he has to be reminded to go home. A square is a guy who doesn't want to stop at the bar and get all juiced up because he prefers to go to his own home, his own dinner table, and his own bed. He hasn't learned to cut corners or goof off. This creep we call a square gets all choked up when he hears the children singing, My Country 'Tis of Thee. He even believes in God and says so in public. A square is a guy who lives within his means, whether the Joneses do or not. And he thinks Uncle Sam should too. He gets his books out of the library instead of the drugstore, and he tells his son it's more important to play fair than to win. Imagine, he reads the scriptures when nobody's watching and prays when nobody's listening. is a guy who thinks Christmas trees should be green and the gifts hand-picked. A square wants to see America first in everything. He believes in honoring father and mother, do unto others, and that kind of stuff. He thinks he knows more than his teenagers knows about car freedom and curfew. So will all you Goonie Birds answering the description, please stand up. You misfits in this brave new age, you dismally disorganized, improperly apologetic ghosts of the past, stand up and be counted. You squares who turn the wheels and dig the fields and move mountains and put rivers in our dreams. You squares who dignify the human race. You squares who hold the thankless world in its place. Now, you know, the situation we find ourselves in today, and I don't know, I just have a feeling in the back of my mind, back of my heart, that when this 20th, when the millennium starts and we start looking Y2K in the face, we may be privileged to watch one of the greatest spectacles in the history of mankind. If our computers go down, it'll affect our medical systems, it'll affect our communication, our transportation, it'll affect everything. And I don't know, when you stop to think, to get all these computers programmed down to the lower roots, we ain't got about 12, 14 months to get it done. And the way this government moves now, that's not a lot of time. But I think you could say, well, says, what can I do, the situation this country's in, no, what can I do or how can I contribute to making a difference? Well, I've thought about it and I've come up with this. I know right from wrong, and what is right, I know what is right. If we'll commit ourselves and rededicate ourselves to making ourselves into the best person we can be based on the right principles and right morals, we can have an effect and impact down the road, because everybody, I don't care who it is, how small, how high and mighty or what, has an influence on somebody else. You can't live your life without having an influence on your family, your friends, your neighbors. And if we'll just rededicate ourselves and commit ourselves to being the best person we can be, just a good Christian citizen, I think that we can make an impact and maybe get this country headed back to where our founding fathers started it out from. So I know the Lord's been good to me, and really by a lot of standards I shouldn't even be here tonight, but I am, and I'm thankful, and I'm going to do my best to make a contribution to the welfare of us all. And I appreciate you gentlemen giving me the opportunity to visit with you tonight and talk to you. I just wish I could talk clearer and plainer, but I've had a 6-week stint on a respirator, and I've got a nodule on my vocal cords, and I can't get up nerve enough to have it cut off. So thank you for bearing with me, and I'm just happy to have been here.
Oh, there may be, does anybody have any questions?
Yeah, if anybody's got any questions about anything what I've said or what might have transpired, I'll be happy to answer.
I know a German doctor to take that nodule off the birth board.
What?
When did you go down?
What? December 1st, 1943.
So you went down just before the Spitfires came in?
No, they, I tell you what, about 30 days before we were shot down. They used to, if you got in 25 missions, you could rotate home, they called. Well, you used to, you could fight count a mission into France, the sub pens at Le Havre or anywhere in Normandy or France. That was a mission. Well, in October of 1943, the losses right after the Swinford raid, the losses were so heavy that it came up in Congress, and Hap Arnold like to got crucified for standing up to do daylight bombing. They was all wanting to go to nighttime bombing like the British. And if they had, there wouldn't have been no further 8th Air Force. But he prevailed on them to give him one more shot. Well, then, when they did, instead of getting, I know we flew two missions up to Norway bombing hydroelectric plants and flew one into Poland. That we got credit for a mission, but really we didn't encounter much opposition or anything. And just like a mission into France, they call it a milk run. And they came out with a directive and an order that on your 25 mission goal to rotate back to state, you had to have 25 missions over Germany, over the continent itself. And that's when it got scary and snaky.
How many did you have?
We got 7 over here. But I tell you.
Now, the Spitfires is when they were able to go with them all the way.
Well, I tell you, the day we went down, the Spitfires, no. The P-47s carried us into as deep as they could. The Spitfires picked us up. Just before we got to the target and was that great for us when it came off. And then the ones, we could see the vapor trails, the P-38s was picking them up, taking them on back. It was the first three-way or coordinated fighter escort on bombers that the 8th Air Force had come up with. They perfected it pretty well on after that, but that was, we were sitting down there. We could see the vapor trail of those fighter pilots up there and knew they was up there, but didn't help us.
How much did you weigh when you came out of there?
93 pounds.
Pilot, now he drowned in the river?
Yeah.
Was that, is that your buddy there?
Yeah, I named Jerry after him.
His first son, so.
He was a good Swedish boy from Minnesota. He was an old flying sergeant. Back, he'd been in the Air Force prior to World War II. And when war broke out, he went through pilot training, and instead of taking a commission, he became a warrant officer. And there was quite a few of them then, but they were strictly old Army or, I know a tail gunner. He was a wild Irishman from Long Island, New York. His name is Healy. And he had been in the 7th Cavalry in the regular Army out in Kansas. Now you talk about somebody that likes to live on the edge. He did, but.
Now what was one panel up there? You were bombardier or what was?
I was bombardier navigator. But my tail gunner, I was supposed to be the first aid officer on the ship when they started strafing the rear of the ship and the tail. Healy called out and said he was hit. So I started back there and did get back there, and we had some sulfonylamide powder and all that, whatever was in the mess first aid kit. And got back there, and I could tell he was shot because he was bleeding up, coming through his clothes. Some down over his head, and I just pulled him up sort of off out of a slouching position and had him, I was on my knees back on my heel. I just pulled him up to try to get him where I could look at him or do something for him. About that time here came a 190 through there ripping it up with a 50 caliber bullets, and they just shot him to pieces right there in front of my, you might say, in my lap. Then when we hit the mouth of the Rhine River, my navigator was knocked out or he was shot, and on the floor of the nose up there and that. So when we hit the water, I said, Chris, come on, let's go up to the cockpit. He didn't move, and I'll never know to this day how I was able to drag him up that catwalk into the cockpit, but somehow I did. But at that time, you act from instinct, not from thinking. It's instinctive reaction from training. And he went, he survived, went back to England, married his girlfriend, came to the States, and he died back a couple of years ago in California with cancer. He married an English girl. And one day I got a phone call. It was Megan. And she said, O'Day said, I just calling you to let you know that Chris wanted me to call you and tell you thanks for 45 years of happy married life. I said, well, what in the world's happened? She said, well, Chris died a couple of weeks ago with cancer out in California. And said he went peacefully and all, but said he just wanted me to call and tell you that thanks for saving his life and giving us 45 years together.
Thank you, O.D. I taped this, and we're probably going to give it to the library as part of our audio package.
It'll be
the city library.
Yeah.
So these things will be there for future generations to hear and so forth. Appreciate you.
Well, I tell you what, you mentioned while I was going to start it, that I was a veteran service officer here for 25 years. Mm-hmm. But I really counted it a privilege, and it was a pleasure to serve the veterans of this county, because I think we had some of the finest that ever put the uniform on. And I wish the last 4.5 years of my career, I let them talk me into going to Montgomery. And I wish I'd had sense enough to stayed at home. And instead of, I got down there and saw what kind of rat race that was, and I said, hell, let me out as quick as I can. I'm going back home. And if I'd stayed at home, I'd have worked till regular retirement age. But I've always said that you talk about mess we've got in Washington inside the Beltway. Well, that's the major leagues in politics. Gold Hill, Montgomery's Triple A. That's where they learn how, because there's more horse swapping and throat cutting going on over on that hill than you can shake a stick at.
O.D., we got a little certificate here from the Lions Club. We had August 25th. That was the original date you were scheduled. Here it is, October 27th.
Well, I appreciate that, Bill.
The date, that's about your speaking here. And Vice President Jim Fowler has this. Jim, I'll let you tell them what you got there.
I worked a couple of years ago on a brief history of the Lions Club.
I thought you might like
to thumb through it.
Well, yeah.
One of the interesting things while you were talking there, and you may have smoked some of them, this club established a drive to provide cigarettes for the boys over there, over 100,000.
Cigarettes were a big deal.
Yeah.
Well, you know, just show you how your hindsight's better. Of course, that thing. Mm-hmm. When my wife and my sister started sending me food parcels, they called it, why, they were very careful and sent me plenty of vitamin tablets.
Yeah.
But fool-like, I didn't take them. I'd give them away or just let them go to pot. Now that I came out and then what I've gone through, I wished I'd taken every one of them. But you just don't know.
Hope you enjoy it, Artie.
All right, I'm sure will.
Thank you for coming in, O.D.
Veterans Day 2006. You've been listening to the late O.D. Tully speaking at the Gunnersville Lions Club meeting in October of 1998. O.D. Tully was the longtime veteran service officer for Marshall County.